Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is summary of episode 10, where we watched and discussed a classic 1957 film, 12 Angry Men. To see the movie and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, speaking to you from London, capital of the United Kingdom. In order to commemorate reaching our first 10 episodes, we decided to do something different and, instead of reading a book or an article, we talked about a film relevant to management. 12 Angry Men is actually great for that, as it brilliantly portrays group dynamics, consensus building and leadership. It even dabbles in social epistemology, to my great delight, the study of how groups of people generate and qualify what counts as knowledge. One of the most relevant contributions to management in the film, however, is a demonstration of how to manage a hostile situation at work. This was one of recurrent themes in our discussion, and I will come back to that in a few minutes. For those of you who haven't seen the movie, well, go and watch it. It's free, and we even have a link on the episode page on our website. Seriously, you're not likely to regret it. In the event that my call to action actually persuaded you, please pause this and return when you're done, as there are major spoilers ahead. So the premise of the situation in the film is such. 12 jurors are locked in a room where they have to arrive at a verdict for a murder case. It seems that the prosecution has done its job well, and it is all but certain that a 16-year-old boy in fact murdered his father with a switchblade knife. The murder weapon is there, as are the witnesses who saw and heard him do it. If you sense that all this sounds compelling, especially if you imagine yourself in the 1950s, then you're in good company of 11, not yet angry, men of the jury. The odd one out, juror number 8, played by Henry Fonda, is not convinced, and so votes not guilty, thus triggering the events of the film. This moment of Henry Fonda voting against an absolute majority is already noteworthy in terms of management and power. In a situation where everyone has to agree to cooperate, as is the case in many knowledge-intensive organizations, but not necessarily line manufacturing, so in this kind of a situation, placing oneself against the rest is actually a significant power move. And here's why. If everyone needs to be on board in order to accomplish the task, jumping ship, so to speak, creates a discursive space where either the odd person out has to be convinced to realign with the majority, or the majority has to have its stance adjusted. Or, of course, it can just lead to a group failure. In the case of 12 Angry Men, Henry Fonda's character, juror number 8, demonstrates how to exploit this discursive space that he created by going up against all the other jurors. The first thing he does, and this is a valuable leadership lesson, is he does not place himself in the opposition to everyone else. When challenged by other jurors about his not guilty verdict, he states that he does not know and that he wishes to talk things through. This is a brilliant tactic. During the discussion, we almost unanimously agreed that had we found ourselves in a similar situation, the likely response would have been to point out how everyone else is wrong and why. But that, of course, would have created direct opposition. Juror number 8, by contrast, just wanted to talk. There's a great lesson about tact and ego to take note of here. Few people want to be told that they're wrong, but many will be open to just talking. Once the renegotiation, or reinterpretation, as you will, space is created, the entire fabric of the case, with all the evidence and prejudice that came along with it, began to unravel. There are two components to that, material evidence and people. Material evidence is basically the murder weapon, and juror number 8 quickly undermines the strength of that by proving that the knife, contrary to popular belief, is not unique at all, and there really is not that much more to it. The people bit, however, is much more interesting. There are two witnesses who claim to have seen the crime in one way or another. One, a woman who saw the accused boy from the street, and two, an old man who lived below the crime scene, heard a struggle, and then saw the boy run past his front door and out of the building. Both times the motivation and reliability of human knowledge and memory is called into question. This is done in two different ways. In the case with a woman, juror number 8 draws on what is technically called localized knowledge. You can refer to our episode 5 on Mary Parker Follett for more on that. And in the case with the old man, juror number 8 also conducts an experiment which proves that the testimony is inaccurate. Did they lie? One might legitimately ask. Well, no. Or maybe. We will never know, because they do not exist, and in any case, their fictional moral backbone is irrelevant here. Henry Fonda's character just suggests that they may not have remembered accurately what happened. This instance of misremembering is particularly interesting to me, given my specialism in organizational memory. There are two main concepts here that are relevant. One is that memory is not something that you just put away in a time capsule and then retrieve in a pristine form when needed. And two, that memories are generated every time from new and always given the currently available information. This may include power relations, interpersonal relations, broader social zeitgeist, whether the person who does the remembering is hungry or thirsty, you get where I'm going. So, in terms of the movie, Henry Fonda, with the assistance of local knowledge kindly provided by other jurors, calls into question the accuracy of memories of the witnesses based on the circumstances of when the remembering happened, namely in the witness box in the court. In both cases, the jurors conclude that both witnesses had a deep personal need to be heard, seen, and acknowledged by others, to be useful and to not disappoint. All the stuff commonly associated with a capricious and marginalized ego, in other words. Something similar occurs with the autopsy report, so there is really no need to go into that in any detail. It is sufficient to say that juror number 8 does a remarkable job at showing others that facts are not carved in stone, especially when there are agendas at play. All of this does not happen smoothly, however. From the very beginning, we observed a rigid social hierarchy emerging where different opinions scuffled to establish a dominant social order. Now, you may not find this terribly surprising, especially if you ever worked in a group of any kind, but the person who emerged at the head of the mainstream was the loudest of the jurors. Using strong and assertive, often racist language, establishing and maintaining control over the discursive space by shutting some of the other jurors out, and being consistently driven by personal insecurities, juror number 3 unsuccessfully yet persistently resisted Henry Fonda throughout the film. This struggle between the two we discussed is conceptually reflective of what Max Weber, subject of our episode number 6, was reacting to when he laid out the ideal type of bureaucracy. Specifically, we saw an illustration of how different types of authority compare and contrast with each other. Juror number 3 was impulsive, loud, entitled, and, frankly, kind of a bully. This, in part, makes him very much a representative of what Weber termed charismatic authority, the most basic type of authority. Juror number 8, played by Henry Fonda, on the other hand, was quiet, considerate, scientifically methodical, and almost entirely uninvested into the process on a personal level. This makes him very rational legal authority-esque, which is the only kind of authority allowed in a just and fair bureaucracy-centered organization of society and work. In the end, the systematic re-evaluation of facts and testimonies results in a spectacular comeback for the rational method of Henry Fonda and a spectacular emotional breakdown of juror number 3. The jurors give their verdict and go home, and we are left to wonder how successful juror number 8 would have been had he not effectively held the rest of the jurors hostage with his initial not guilty vote. To listen to a more in-depth discussion of these issues, examples from our personal work experience, and some questionable jokes about Elton Mayo from episode 9, please go ahead and listen to the full episode. You can find it on all major podcast directories, as well as on our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. I hope that you enjoyed this summary, and I urge you to get in touch with some feedback so that we can continue developing this segment further. Next week, we are going to read and discuss a 1995 paper by Birley and Spender on culture and high reliability, here on Talking About Organizations.